Well, my friends, here we go again. I'm Michelle Sawatsky-Coop, and we have another amazing story to tell about another hero in our midst. You know, every time I'm at the beginning of a story, I feel like this sense of anticipation of what we're going to be when we're done hearing it. Kylo Harris spends his days at Sport Manitoba, and he came about his passion for youth in sport in the most adventurous of ways, and I know he has a great story to tell us. Now, how did we find Kylo and decide to include him as one of our heroes? Well, Donna Harris was part of the team that started Heroes in Our Midst. And back in the beginning, we each decided to pick our own heroes as a start to what has turned into an incredible list of guests. And as Kylo's wife, Donna knows him better than anyone and picked him as her hero. And there is great reason for it. My friends, this story takes us, well, all over the place. So you are in for a ride. Sit back and prepare to be inspired as we thank Kylo for taking the time to join us.
Yeah, thank you. It's been fun. I've been fortunate enough to listen to a bunch of the stories that have already been shared, and it'll be interesting to see. Everyone, I think, has the same opinion. Are they not necessarily a hero when they listen to everyone else's stories? So it's a little bit humbling to listen to some of the ones that have been shared already, but I'm happy to have the dialogue. It's always fun to talk about things in general, especially at this time when you don't get to talk to a lot more people outside of your household.
Well, Kylo, I know that you have a unique story. You've done a lot of things that many of us can only imagine, stuff that movies are made of. And we'll get to that later on in the story, and people will understand if they don't already. Kylo, maybe before we go back, you know, to your childhood and all that good stuff, tell us what you're doing now and how you spend your days now and what life is like for you day to day.
Sure. Yeah. Well, employment-wise, I'm fortunate enough I get to work at Sport Manitoba, and across my journey thus far, sport's been a big piece of my life, and so I'm lucky to have landed there. I've been there now for, 2008, I think, is when I started. Someone can do the math quickly on that, 13-ish years. A couple different roles in that organization, but get to work with committed community volunteers and people passionate about sport, just about making quality sport programs across the province and creating experiences and opportunities for youth to participate and gain the benefits of what it means to be a participant in sport.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. And how did you find your way in sport? Do your earliest memories include sport?
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in Labrador, fly in, fly out community in Goose Bay, and I was your standard rink rat. I was at the rink all the time. So much so that my mom got a job at the canteen just because that's where we were spending our time anyway. And so I was, there playing with any program. Anytime there's free ice, I could get on it. If it was public skate, I was skating. If it was hockey practices or camps or playing with the seniors because they needed a pickup in the rec team, I was a goalie. So I had lots of demand, right? So you get to be that spot where I always need to have a goalie in place. No one wants to shoot on the shooter tutor for too long. I did that. And then I was your standard multi-sport athlete growing up in a community. We were about 10,000 at that time in Goose Bay. You were a multi-sport athlete. So I did judo at the same time that I did hockey. And then at high school and school, I was in every sport and after school club that you could do. So it really was where I spent all of my free time. If we weren't in organized, I was literally in a sand lot between trailers playing pickup baseball with our friends. And I've got many more pickup sport injuries with a bat to the head, being the back catcher, not wearing the proper equipment than I do from organized sport. So it's really defined my childhood. And ultimately, when it came time to look at post-secondary, those were the things. And you mentioned being able to find to do what you wanted to do or passion. So I knew I wanted to work in the sport world, but the only thing I knew was for my profession was recreation. I knew our local rec director. I worked in our summer rec camps when I was doing summer jobs. And so I didn't really know there was organized paid sport roles. And so I started doing a little bit of digging and looking and thought, well, maybe the professional sport world, that's where there's must be jobs because there's NHL teams, there's NBA teams, that's got to be paid profession, and started looking for opportunities in that pathway and stumbled upon a program in Sudbury at Laurentian University, what was a commerce degree in sports administration. And I actually found two. I found one there and one, I believe at the time, was in McGill. And so trying to figure out where I'm a diehard Habs fan. I love the Canadians. And so there's a little tug there to think to go to McGill might be the way to go. But I did not, nor do I fluently speak French. McGill was a little bit bigger than Sudbury, and Sudbury was a little bit bigger than Goose Bay. And so it was sort of like, I don't know that I'm ready to make that jump to a school that's much larger than my community. So Sudbury looked favorable. And then I also had the thought process, all my friends were going to the universities in the Maritimes, whether it be Memorial in Newfoundland, University of New Brunswick, St. FX, Acadia, and nobody was talking about going to Ontario. And so I debated, you know, maybe I can go and do a business degree at UMB, be with friends from high school, and stumble into the sport world afterwards. And maybe that'll be, you know, I can be lucky enough. But for whatever reason, I decided, no, I might as well just go to Sudbury and do the degree that I want and, you know, pack up. And my parents drove us out. So we took the 3-4 day drive from Goose Bay out to Sudbury and dropped me off there. And that was an interesting experience. For sure, campus was half the size of my town. I remember walking down the hallways after my mom and dad went back to the hotel and I was in the residence. And I literally felt about the size of an ant. Like I can remember the feeling walking and everyone around me looking, and I had no idea where I was, what I was doing. It was just such a interesting feeling to feel that small. Everyone around me was towering over me, and they weren't. I mean, I'm 6 foot, whatever I am. And so, but I felt so tiny.
And what a transition for anyone coming from a place like Goose Bay. Everything's far away. I just can't even imagine. So you do obviously have a heart for small town, but that wasn't necessarily where you went, small town, after that. It kind of got bigger after that. So continue your story.
Kind of like most Newfoundlanders, at some point in time, you don't get the opportunity to return to home and work. There's not a lot of jobs available. And again, I didn't even know that professional sport jobs existed still at this time, or sport jobs at the government level. Like that wasn't a thing that was on my radar. And so trying to find my way in the world of the sport industry, I ended up in the big city of Toronto. And friends that I met at university all lived in Southern Ontario. And over my 4 years there, I went to visit them and had that experience. And so I grew up over that time, getting familiar with Ontario. Literally, Sudbury was the first time I was on a road that had two lanes going in the same direction, right? Like it was that crazy of my experience. Like we had one stoplight in Goose Bay that went in after I left. Like we didn't have a stoplight in town. So all that was really interesting and learning. But yeah, Toronto, you know, seemed to be okay. My friends from university were going there. I could bunk in with them and try to make a go of it. Ultimately, in that first iteration in trying to go to Toronto, it didn't work out. I didn't have the opportunity to connect with a job or find a place. And I don't know that I was ready to be there. And so I ultimately packed up my truck and drove back out to Alberta where my parents were. At that time, you figured, okay, well, let's see what's going on. I knew I wanted to do some traveling. At that point, the world had started to open up, right? And I'm like, oh, well, a lot of people do this backpacking thing. Maybe I'll go. And Alberta's giving out money left, right, and center to anybody who will pick up a shovel. So I'll go and make a bit of money there and maybe go travel overseas. And so that's what I did. I drove out to Alberta, which was the first time I lived in Alberta. My parents moved there while I was at university. So my third year, my dad got transferred out. He was working a civilian, working for the military in Goose Bay, and the Department of National Defense privatized that base. And so they relocated him. He had a couple options. And so they opted to go to Alberta, just outside of Edmonton. Big switch for them, obviously, as well. I mean, he was working in the Air Force versus working with the Army. Is a big different culture in those places. And so, yeah, I packed up and took the truck, a little four-cylinder, five-speed Ford Ranger with a U-Haul in tow. Didn't have much in the U-Haul. I don't know why I had that. And drove straight through to Alberta, to Edmonton, and got a couple labor jobs there, just working in housing developments, doing backfill on the septic and water lines as they were putting them in, and worked at a bar on the weekends and stop work at my labor job at 7 and I'd go to work at the bar and I'd come home and I'd shower and I'd be back out at the on site for 7 in the morning and did that till about September, October. And then I had saved up enough money and I booked it on a plane to London and did some backpacking through the United Kingdom and got to go to France and see some of the war sites there. And there's a really big Newfoundland Memorial in Beaumont Hamel from World War I. And so I went there and saw the markers for a couple of great uncles that fought in the war and did that. Went to Munich and got to take part in Oktoberfest. Got up to the Isle of Skye and really just learned how to navigate independence and how to depend on people, when to call on people. So I ended up doing a bunch of what is called willing workers on organic farms. And that was how I funded my, so they gave you accommodations and food often. And so I did a bit of work during the day and ended up connecting with a guy from Australia. And he and I did a bunch of traveling together and met a group of people from Germany and the Netherlands who all spoke 6 languages. Sort of depressing that I came from a bilingual country and that I didn't speak French fluently. So it was actually on a vineyard where I was doing some work with this group of multinational individuals. And they were all so excited that the Canadian was there. Like, oh, you're from Canada. Like the Niagara Falls, they want to see Niagara Falls. I'm so excited. You must just love it. And here I was, having lived in Toronto, lived in Ontario, and I had never seen the falls. And, you know, the Rocky Mountains are so great. Like, I want to come to Canada and see them. And right before traveling to Europe, I had lived in Edmonton. I never made the drive into the Rocky Mountains. I'd never been to Banff, to Jasper. I looked at them, but I'd never gone there. And I'm like, this is silly. When I got home, I really had an idea that there's a lot of Canada that I should probably see before I start going back to Australia and New Zealand and all those places. And so I really came back from that with a good appreciation for Canada and what we have and you know, making it a priority to get to all corners of Canada and see certain things.
I love how you brought that around and that it gave you really an appreciation for the country that we live in. And so obviously you're collecting all of this experience. Where did that sort of land you?
Yeah, so I came back to Alberta. My folks were still there and still trying to then, you know, look at that idea of working in sport. And had applied on a job with an organization that provides corporate hospitality at sporting events. And so they would do the Masters, the Indy 500, and all of these sorts of organizations. You know, I still have my university friends that were living in Toronto. And I was actually a friend of mine who now lives in BC. When we were at school and university, he said, you know, you never forget your friends from high school, but you never lose contact with your friends from university. And sort of, it's been really true. You know, that group of people that I met in Sudbury have been a major part of my life and experiences. And so they were in my age and plugging away and trying to make the go of the corporate world in Toronto. And I applied on this job and thought, I want to get back there. And sure enough, I got the job. A friend of mine, a really good family friend, a friend of our family now, he was living in a house with about 7 other guys. And they were sort of north end of Toronto. And he said, well, we got a living room, you can put up a sheet and you can live there. I'm like, all right, well, I got this job, like, why not? But I packed up the truck and I drove it back to Ontario. It took a lot less with me this time, and you know, for a while lived in this house with 7 other people that had 2 bedrooms. I'm pretty sure is all it was. One guy lived under the stairs, but I had a sheet that pulled across the living room, and we, you know, my friend and I, he was working downtown, we'd jump on the subway together and we'd go downtown and did that. And then it was telephone sales. And while I like to talk, I like people. And I wasn't interacting with people. And you really just sat at this cubicle and you dialed out and there was no connections with people. You were just trying to get past the gatekeeper person to talk to this Fortune 500 company's purse strings holder. And I'm like, anyone that I was, I was successful. I was, you know, able to get some good sales and whatever, had a sales of the month record one time and did all that, but it was just boring. It wasn't fun. Right? The only reason I was successful is because I would talk to the person at the gatekeeper and I would build a relationship with that person. And ultimately they would just say, yeah, you're not a terrible person. I'll let you talk to so-and-so. I'll find a way in. It wasn't where I wanted to be. I bounced around a bit, ended up doing advertising sales with Rogers Media for a Plastics magazine. And I did that and I was able to go out and meet with people, but I wasn't really enjoying life. This time, my friend who had lived in the house with seven people who I moved back with, he had gotten married and moved to Nunavut. And so it was one of those things. I went from a house of seven to a house of five, to a house of three, to a house of two. Everyone was getting married and moving on with their lives. And I was sort of that guy still, who's single and who needs a roommate? I'm not in that point yet. And so ultimately, I was doing that in Toronto. I'm like, I'm tired of Toronto. I don't like the heat, right? So every time I stepped outside and got on the subway, my clothes stuck to me and it was terrible. It was muggy. I really didn't enjoy it. And so his wife and him, they were, we have an extra room. You know, you can come up here. People are always looking for jobs. And if nothing else, you can say you were north of the Arctic Circle. So they were in Cambridge Bay, Nunavut at that time. And I'm like, yeah, why not? I'm tired of this. Let's go. So I put a bunch of stuff in storage and I buggered off to Nunavut and really enjoyed that. And that's how I landed to be in the north originally from my return back to Canada. And of course, it was nice that it also checked off another part of the country that I hadn't been to and hadn't seen. And so I'm like, after that traveling Europe and that notion that there's a lot in Canada, I'm like, well, yeah. I mean, how many people have actually been north of the Arctic Circle, right? So
when you moved up there, did you know what you would be doing when you got there? Or?
Yeah, no idea other than they said there's lots of people, they lots of casual work. I had no expenses. They were both teachers with a spare room. And so they said, we got this room, you can stay here. And ultimately, when if you land work, we can, you know, I can cost share some of the living expenses. But again, they were friends from university and just happy to have, you know, you can come hang out. And yeah, I went up there. I ended up guarding at the jail at times at the RCMP local jail. I ended up substitute teaching for a while. I ended up doing some part-time recreation work for the hamlet there because it's so small. It's right. It's a hamlet with a CAO. It's not a town or a village. And then ultimately ended up as the sounds like a big title, really the executive director of the daycare society, which essentially meant I ran the books for the daycare, right? And so I did that as probably my most full-time permanent gig there. And I was in Cambridge Bay for about 2 years doing that. And all the while, still very much involved in sports. So I landed in probably within few weeks I was involved in coaching soccer. They needed someone to help out on the soccer program. And I mean, they play indoor soccer in a gymnasium, not exactly futsal. It's a different version of soccer where the walls are in play. And so they needed people to coach. And so I started coaching that. And my friend that I moved up there with, Rich Marwick, he was a lacrosse player in Ontario. And so he won two national championships. So quite an accomplished lacrosse player, and a community nearby had started lacrosse in Nunavut. There's three regions and there's five communities in our region. We were in the Kitikmeot, and a neighboring community had started a lacrosse program and kids were really excited about it. And so kids in our town said, hey, you know, my cousin is playing lacrosse over there. I'd like to try it. And so I'd never played lacrosse, but Rich did. And so we started a little intro to lacrosse program in Cambridge Bay and started getting some kids to come out and participate on the evenings. And we started that. And ultimately, that led into a whole bunch of other areas for me. But they ultimately left. They were emergency foster care parents for a young girl. And they ended up adopting her. And it was a long, lengthy process. But yeah, so they, after that sort of came through and they had done their thing and they were ready to move on to the next stage of their life, my friends and with this little one. And so they wanted to move home and thinking about raising a family and where they wanted to be. And they have strong family connections. So they are back in Orillia near there. Both their families are from. So they are back there and wanted to do that. And I wasn't ready to leave. And so I said, I'm not gone yet. I don't know what I'm going to do. And ended up working in recreation in Cambridge Bay and still finding random roommates that needed a person to share rent with. So I did that. And during that time, the lacrosse program, I kept running it in town and I was learning how to throw and catch as well as the athletes were because I had no background with it. And so ultimately we brought in the neighboring community, Kugluktuk. We brought in the people there that were running lacrosse and said, hey, come over and run some clinics and camps for our kids. I don't know what I'm doing. Like, help us out. And We funded it through REC and with the help of Sport Nunavut, running camps, and they came over. And ultimately, in those discussions, I learned more about the Kugluktuk High School Grizzlies program, what they were doing as a stay-in-school initiative, how they were using sport as a catalyst to engage. And I'm like, well, we need to do that in our community. We developed a relationship with the staff, mostly teachers in Kugluktuk that were doing that, and how we could implement it in Cambridge Bay. And so we started trying to do similar things in Cambridge, and they were growing. And the guy said, well, you know what? We need a staff person. Like, we can't do this as volunteers anymore, and we need to hire someone. And you seem to be along the same lines of what we're doing. What do you think? Would you move over? Would you come here and do this job? We don't know what it is. We've never really had a person in it before, but you know, we'll call it an executive director, and we'll find a way to fund it through grants. And I'm like, yeah, this sounds good. I think I'm enjoying what I'm doing, and maybe there's something there. So I ended up leaving Cambridge Bay, and I went by snow machine. I packed up all my stuff and sent it on the plane, and took a 3-day snowmobile ride across the tundra in the Arctic with some of the Northern Rangers as guides. So this group of three of us on sleds, and they brought their family in a Komatik, and we stopped at cabins along the way that they knew of, and we hunted some caribou, and there's all sorts of stories about that. But yeah, I packed up and I sent all my stuff to this random person in Kugluktuk who I had never met, who was going to be there when I landed. And that person actually now is became a good friend, and they live in Manitoba, Dave Little, who's the now rec director in La Broquerie. And so, yeah, such a small world. And yeah, that's how I ended up in Kugluktuk to start work with the High School Athletics Association there.
Now, by the time you arrived in Kugluktuk, from what you're saying, the Grizzlies program was already up and running, and pretty neat how that even spilled over to where you were in Cambridge Bay. But I guess when you came to the program, that was a step up for them, as you're saying, and you became executive director of whatever it might be. Yeah. Wow. I mean, I just love the adventure it was for you just to get there. But what an adventure to sort of get involved in this program, and many things, amazing things. Were they already well on their way to having improved sort of life for young people in Kugluktuk, or were you able to sort of see that happen?
Yeah, no, they were well established. Russ Shepherd is the individual who is sort of the backbone of it that pushed it. They were already doing a bunch of sports, and they had some suicide issues in the community. And there's a couple features out there. ESPN had done some stuff, and so some people may have seen the features. But ultimately, these teachers were not going to settle for the fact that this is what the status quo was. And so they decided to use sport as that carrot. You know, the students love sport. Sport was a way to engage on a, you know, we always call it the positive gang. That's how students got to travel. Kugluktuk and all the North communities are fly in, fly out. There's not one that's a road accessible town. Getting to travel is a big adventure. And it's something they decided, the coaches at that time, let's make it something they earn. And so they created more of a, how can you earn this right to be part of the sport program? Mm-hmm. And so there was a attendance, they created a bit of an attendance record sheet. You had to have a performance log where the teachers would evaluate you on your effort, not on your marks. But if you were coming to school and you were in class engaged and you were trying to do what you needed to do, then you would get a good performance review on a weekly basis. And you had to do that for the 3 months of the sports season. And if you maintain that and you maintain your attendance to 80%, then you could earn your right to be on that sport team. So whether that was volleyball, soccer, badminton, sort of your standard school sports that were occurring. And so they really started it from that point and created that, you know, identity with a logo. So they created the Grizzlies as their mascot, as their identity team for the school, and built this affiliation to that sporting world and what that meant to earn the right. And so that it established, and that's what, you know, when I first came across them and learned about it, I took our Cambridge Bay girls soccer team to regionals in Kugluktuk, and that was sort of my exposure to it. And I'm like, this is fantastic. Like, I don't know what you're doing, but we need to do it back where I am. And sort of we started to put in similar processes and sort of of course, I would be back and forth with them all the time saying, okay, how did you do this? Like when I was in Cambridge. And so ultimately that relationship built that way based on the respect for what they were doing. And they were getting recognition across the region and across the country. CBC North had done a story on them at that time, and other communities like Baker Lake, Nunavut, Iqaluit, they all wanted to implement similar concepts. And so the idea for my position when I started talking to Russ about it was, we need someone to help grow this across the territory. Like, it's bigger than what we're doing locally. And what we're doing locally is growing so much. They took Grizzly members to Mexico for a student trip. They were doing exchanges, but it's all funded by fundraising, right? And we needed more effort to manage the program's growth. And that's sort of where I came in. You know, they were running a business at that time. They had started, and there was an arcade in town that was run by a family. And that arcade had closed, and the students had nowhere to be. And so they decided, and two of those youth were of the family that ran it were Grizzly members. And so they reestablished the arcade, and they ran it by the Grizzly members. You had to be a member to be a staff person there. You had to abide by the same policy. So now it wasn't just athletes. If you wanted to get a job and earn an income, then, you know, we had an opportunity, but you had to come to school and you had to make an effort, right? And so it really started as that. And the spinoff of it was, you know, for a long period of time, there was no successful suicides. I went to a conference in Yellowknife around computer access program. And on the flight, I talked to the pilot, and he said, you know, we used to come in all the time and do medevacs out of Kugluktuk, like regularly. And he said, it's not happening now. So we chatted, and I said, yeah, like, you know, this program is there. The kids are engaged. And, you know, not that there wasn't attempted, because we're not reaching everybody, but there was not a completed suicide. It didn't go, and it wasn't to the volume that it was when the Grizzly program started. And so we knew that there was something happening. Right. And so Russ and the group that were involved, the teachers and Dave and people that I met there, they really wanted to share that as a best practice across Nunavut and other places. And so that's where I came in, as to, you know, how do we grow it for ourselves, but also how do we help set up templates that other communities, and can you be the contact person when they say, hey, we want to start one up? Because everyone else was a teacher. They were in the classroom from 9 to 5, and then they were in the gym from, you know, 5 to 7, and then they were at the bingo hall from 7 to 10 doing fundraising, right? Like that's what you did if you were involved in the program there, right? So like, I can't help field all these calls from Baker Lake, Iqaluit, that want to start programs, but we want to help. And really that's how I got on board, and that was the role that I started filling for the first little bit that I was there.
You know, Kylo, I think it's so good for us to hear this kind of thing, because for those of us who live where, or maybe grew up where there was opportunity, and we're so fortunate in Manitoba to have had sport, but when it isn't there, I don't think we understand what a hole that leaves, and what a hole it can fill for young people. And really, literally, to hear about the suicide rate completely changing in a place like Kugluktuk, I mean, that's life and death for these kids, to have motivation, to have something to belong to have reason, right? And to have people that they know care about them, and that they matter to a program, and to give them motivation to be at school and to better themselves and all of that. And it kind of seems to me like, wow, you know, you just gave them a sport to play, but it just became so much more than that. That must have been incredibly fulfilling. And obviously you said like this, I mean, many communities wanted this to grow in their communities as well. But speaking of raising awareness, I mean, when did this, the whole movie, The Grizzly, some people might be listening going, oh, I've heard about this. Wait a second. You know, I've heard about this story, or this story has been told. I know you were a bit of a part of it, and maybe just tell us what part you had in it, and when did the movies come to be? And I would be curious, how true is it? Is it a good, would you recommend watching it? Is it a good movie? Is it a good representation of what was really going on?
Yeah, a lot of it comes out of, you know, the lacrosse side of it was where the story gets picked up and what we were doing there. And it's a little bit, you know, I was part of the lacrosse program. I was coaching the lacrosse program as well, helping out. But it really, we center on that, but it could have been a story on the soccer team or the badminton team or the table tennis team that started Like it could have been any one of those sports, but it got picked up on the lacrosse side because the tie to the Indigenous side of things. And so there was people from Six Nations in Southern Ontario, New York, who heard about it, and they flew down some of the lacrosse players, and they wanted to have, you know, share what was happening and bring them into, if you know anything about the sport of lacrosse, I mean, it is a Six Nations sport. There is nothing else that matters more in a sporting world to them than the creator's game and lacrosse, right? It's so much part of their livelihood and where it comes from. And so, you know, the thing that, you know, people from Six Nations had reached out to kids in Nunavut, said, hey, you're doing lacrosse. We want to share the game with you. That was really cool. And to connect the dots in a real official line, I might miss some of the steps, right? So I apologize to Russ or Dave that might listen, but, you know, so we had that experience that got picked up. And ultimately from there, someone in the Northeast of the US who is from Ontario and knows lacrosse and they got wind of it. And they're like, hey, well, we run this True North lacrosse program out of Philadelphia. Like, why don't you guys come down? Or there was a tie to the Worlds event. And so this trickled down about exposure, right? But through the sport of lacrosse. And ultimately, when they were in, they being the coaches and athletes that went to Philadelphia, ESPN got wind of this group being there. And they're like, well, that's a neat story. Like, we need to tell this story, right? You know, how do we connect? And so ultimately, ESPN picked up this story about these athletes from Nunavut through, you know, these multiple opportunities that we had been given and that we were able to provide for the athletes, right? And so sure enough, ESPN comes up to Kugluktuk with their then really fancy new technology HD camera that they had no idea how it was going to work when they put it in the cold. It was really interesting, right, to have these and people come and do footage on us. And at that time, Kugluktuk made up the bulk of Nunavut lacrosse. And so we were competing at the Nationals here in Winnipeg. And so they came to Winnipeg and did a bit of a footage on Team Nunavut there. And it's still on YouTube. If you Google or search on YouTube, the Kugluktuk Grizzlies, you can see it's about a 8 to 12 minute ESPN clip that aired nationally during like College Bowl season in the US, like in January. But yeah, there's now this story from this town of 1,100 people in north of Nunavut that's airing on primetime bowl season in the US. And ultimately, another lacrosse person had seen it in the professional lacrosse world and had reached out and made contact with Russ, who was our point person primarily. And, you know, they got talking about how do we tell this story more? And then this notion of a movie came out of it. And, you know, it was a long time in writing a script and creating it. And they didn't really know if it was going to be something. It is a story, like maybe it will, maybe it won't, I don't know, but they were willing to back it. And it's a good thing that this isn't a sponsor area because I'm terrible with names and organizations. So I can't remember the individual's name, but you know, they worked with Russ to create this story and it lived for a long time. Russ left, Kugluktuk, went back to get his MBA and law degree afterwards. And so he's now a practicing lawyer. In Alberta, I left, came to Manitoba shortly after Dave left. And so the North is transient. That happens. None of us have lost our connection to the North. People will tell you once you live in the North, it's part of you. And for sure, all of us would be, Russ calls Kugluktuk home. When he refers to it, that's where he's home now. And he's from Saskatchewan. But we all left and moved on. And during that time, the notion of a movie continued and Russ continued to work with them. And ultimately, they pitched it to someone or someone got wind of it and they said, no, we need to tell the story. This is good stuff. We need to share this. And so, yeah, over a course of 3 or 4 years ago, they started bringing together Canadian director. And it was what's really interesting. Stacey McDonald is co-producer or co-director. I can't remember exactly. She's a Grizzly athlete. She went through our program. She was a volleyball athlete. And so she got to be part of bringing the story to life, to main screen. And that's where she works now out of Iqaluit. And her younger sister played one of the roles, one of the lead roles in the story. So yeah, it came to being. The Grizzly movie aired a couple of years ago in theaters pre-pandemic. We went and watched it and I cried. And but it's a good story, right? Like,
it's heavy stuff, Kylo. When we think of sport, we often think of the stories of just getting cut or making a team. This is life-changing. I mean, the story that the Grizzlies program represents is wow. And you worked with these kids. I mean, you felt that when you watched it. I mean, there must have been times where I can hear the emotion now. It still hits you and probably always will, because it was so deep inside of you, your care for these kids. And the fact that the movie portrayed these stories, did you walk alongside some of these young people in some of these difficulties? Was this movie real for you?
Oh yeah, for sure. I think the storylines, it's a movie, right? It's made, it's entertainment. There's stuff in there that did not happen that makes a good story, right? There's pieces of it that just enhance the story. So some of it's exaggerated or amplified, right? But the reality is, yeah, I mean, the ESPN clip, when you read the story about Kyle, or see the story about Kyle, he's a center figure in the story of the Grizzlies movie, and Adam, right? Those storylines are pretty accurate. That's what those athletes were going through. That's what those young men were going through. It's really a good portrayal of some of that stuff. And Russ was really keen that it's not a white savior, right? We talk about this idea that people come in and that we're going to go in and save the world. And we would talk about three people move north. There's three people that move north, right? There's those that are going to save the world, and they last about 3 months. And then they leave. And there's those that go for the paycheck, and they last about a year before they get cabin fever and they can't stand it anymore. And there's those that go for the adventure. And ultimately it's those that go for the adventure that actually change the world. Hmm. Right? That actually get up there. And they're not there with the purpose, but because they just decide to go up and we're going to do what we think, you know, where can we help out? Where can we pitch in? What can we make available? Right. And I think, you know, that's really the case. And so the story really, Russ was keen that it's not a white savior story, that it was, you know, these kids needed an opportunity to do something and let's make it happen. And that was really how it grew at a grassroots level, right? We engaged them. They were part of the logo design. They were part of the color scheme. They were part of, it was their program. We just knew why programs like that are important and we know what it does. And for me, when we start talking about sport, I always think that you need to go and watch a Special Olympics competition. Because if you want to see sport and what it should be, where everyone is cheering everyone, and it doesn't matter who wins and loses, but it's there for the camaraderie, it's there for the competition. And then you think about a program like the Grizzlies or other programs that are used as a stay in school initiative, and you're like, look how impactful it is. But yet, when we get into sport in mainstream, it's all about who's going to win the provincial championship. It's about, you know, how do we get to the top pinnacle piece of it? And we often forget that at a youth level, it's really about belonging and really about, and those that are going to be excellent are going to be excellent, but don't make it the priority. Make the inclusion, make the opportunity, because you don't know what one kid is coming with that, you know, if they aren't there anymore, because you've created a system that's not welcoming and inviting, you don't know where they end up after that. But I think we need to really, in the sporting world, take measure of that. And if you win a championship, good. But you created a space where someone had their best 2 hours of their day, and they're going to come back 2 days later because of that. And so I think that's really when we look at the sport world. So yeah, I think, I mean, the movie's great. There's definitely some comedy in it. It has to be if you're talking about a topic that difficult and that sort of heavy. So there's some light moments to it, but it's a good reflection of what sport can do for individuals. And it's not just because it's in the North. It's not just because, you know, it's in an isolated community. I mean, this is what youth programming does. And Dave and I, we've had opportunities over the last whatever number of years I've been in Manitoba to deconstruct what was happening with that program. It had a much more profound effect probably on us, on how we approach things. When we created a lacrosse program in Winnipeg, a training program, and what our reason for going and doing it was, what we wanted to make sure was a priority when we were on the field. And we had excellence come out of our program, but we went into it not with that purpose, but knowing that there's other things that quality programs permit athletes to do and achieve. And so it really did impact us on how we program. And, you know, I know it's a big part for him when he thinks about recreation in his community, and when he thinks about what is it, why are we doing it and who are we doing it for? And that's because of our experience. So as much as it shaped the athletes, I think it really had it shaped all the coaches that were involved as well.
A great reminder for all of us not to lose sight of what youth sports should be about. And I think really this story that you're telling and what you've lived redefines winning and success and how important it is. And I think if we even take a moment to imagine what life would be if we didn't have that, if our youth didn't have opportunity, and maybe we're seeing some of that in COVID, and that's why so many sport organizations are working to get kids back to training, all these return to play programs and that. And maybe now in mainstream, we needed this pause to say, hey, the important stuff, because lots of people, I think, in sport, and I'd love for you to comment on this, and I didn't even know we would go here for sure, but this has led me to think about COVID and how our young people have lost sport now across the board, and it's affecting them, and how many organizations are saying, let's forget about worrying about how can we get back to competing. Who cares? We have to get our kids back in the gym and back on the field. And in your work with Sport Manitoba, I mean, is there some reminiscence of the absence of sport and now sort of that drive? Has it changed us a bit?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I think what it's done is really identified what when you talked about earlier, right? That gap of not having it and what fills that gap, right? And I think we're really concerned as a society, right? Like, how do we re-engage with our youth to have, you know, those meaningful opportunities that sport permits and creates opportunities, and that it's not filled up with something else that maybe perhaps, you know, it's music and that's great. But there's other things that become attractive to youth that aren't as positive as sport or music or healthy outlets, right? And really recognizing that. And I think we're hearing a lot on the mental health aspect of it. And so I think that's really concerning for, you know, us in the sport world and parents who want the best for their kids. I think one of the things that I'm hopeful for, and this is the benefit of working in sport, is I get to spend time reading and researching and looking and understanding, is that, you know, we've been talking for a long time that there's a better way to do sport. And, you know, the long-term athlete development model has told us you're not doing it right now. There's some issues we have because we probably put a high emphasis on the competitive side versus what sport brings. And, you know, if we're able to look at sport now with this, the great pause, if we are to say, okay, how do we do it better when we can re-engage with our population, our membership, what does that look like? And my two girls play ringette, you know, they're missing their season, but we would go to the outdoor ice. Like, I can still get activity in. We don't get socialization in, right? But I can get activity in. And so sport is physical activity first and foremost. So how do we get physical activity back? Maybe we can go outside more in unstructured ways, right? As parents, when we want the best for our kids, we don't need to first and foremost look to the structured environment, you know, snowshoeing, cross-country skiing, outdoor rinks, fort building, you know, those are valuable for our mental health and the physical activity side that sport gives us. And then when we do get back to organized sport and ringette, just because it's numbers, it's not a knock on ringette by any means. I love the sport. My girls love it. Do I need to drive 90 minutes to play another team for an hour and drive 90 minutes home? I spend more time sedentary in the car than my children do being active. And wouldn't we be better off having another hour practice in our local community, more skill development, small-sided games, where mom and dad don't have to travel as far, the cost isn't as high. And, you know, at kids, Donna and mine are 8 and 10, if I did the birthdays right, they have lots of time for the competitive world, lots of time to be traveling across the province. But right now they would enjoy 3-on-3 with their friends at the rink as much as they would enjoy traveling to Rouge and playing another team. And maybe that's a result of growing up in Labrador and working in the Grizzlies. I mean, we did house league. We traveled once a year for provincials. You tried out for a traveling team when I grew up. And if you made the traveling team, you flew to 2 tournaments. That was it. The rest of my sport career was played going to my local rink and playing house league hockey. And if teams weren't balanced, we threw another person on the other side and we evened out to teams. But there was coaches on the benches. There was referees. Like, it was sport, right? And so when we lived in Nunavut, you know, it's above the tree line. There's no grass. We were doing field lacrosse. There's no grass out there. But we would play modified indoor lacrosse in a gymnasium, right? And we played all year long. Our first competitive game was generally at nationals. The first time we played a structured game. But we still did sport. Those athletes still had the opportunity to benefit from all of the things that sport provides us. But yet, you know, when we come down into more mainstream and larger connected communities, it's not meaningful if I don't play another community and challenge myself. Like, no, my 10-year-old doesn't care. She enjoys the tournament when we go to Portage because it's a hotel stay, right? They enjoy all of that. But she couldn't tell you what the scores of those games were or the teams we played, right? If we did that and we created a mini tournament in Beausejour and played 3-on-3, she'd enjoy it as much. And the parents would be much more happy because we're not spending time in the car. We're not driving all over the province. And when you think about the Great Pause and long-term athlete development and what those things tell us and you know, what my experience has been with, you know, meaningful sport programming for me, we can do it at a community level without the added cost, which is a barrier, without the added travel, which is a barrier, without the added time commitment, which is a barrier, right? All of those things create reasons why kids can't get involved. We can still have meaningful sport, but it's, we need to be purposeful with it. And we need to say as an organization and as a group that this is quality sport. This is meaningful to give our athletes and our youth what they can benefit from learning skills, from pushing themselves, from being social with their friends, and let them figure out at U14 and U16 to go try out for a team and play in a regional competition when they understand better what that is. And we don't need to do it so early. So I really hope that there's a collective effort from the sporting community. And you know, yes, I work at Sport Manitoba, and yes, we have a role to play. But ultimately, it's every single community club, it's every single community organization who has to say, we can do it better. Like, this doesn't have to be the only way. And I think I'm lucky you mentioned that Donna picked me to do this. And so I get to listen to Donna all the time, right? Like, that's my home field advantage. And so she talked about with her research on passion and the coaches. Now, there isn't just one way to do it, but the system tells us there is. Right now at high performance coaching, right, there's this notion that you've got to be all in, and all in looks like it's going to destroy your life, and that's what we expect. There's not. There's more than one way to do that. But parents think that this is the only way right now. They think it's the one way. And you're going to be all in, and if it's not this, then it's not meaningful. But it can be, and it is. We're just accustomed to the system we've created, and everyone says, oh, well, that must be what's important, and we must only do that. And so maybe COVID creates the opportunity for us to be more critical and to think more holistic on it. And Indigenous sport is really good when they think about the holistic development of the people they're engaged with, right? And so maybe there's times that we can learn from, you know, what does it mean when I'm developing the full person? You know, not all of our sport programs are doing that right now, not because they're purposely trying to not develop it, because we're not thinking through it. And Leisha's Project SCORE that she's created with U of M, and that really gives us coaches tools to do that. But I think collectively the sport world needs to look at how we can do it better, and we'll get excellence. So out of that Grizzlies program, we had kids that ended up playing junior B lacrosse in Alberta. Right? Again, we never played a full-fledged game in it, but they played junior B lacrosse pretty high level. We had kids that went back to Philadelphia that were, you know, Kyle was going down the pathway looking at post-secondary field lacrosse opportunities in the States. We can create champions and we can create success. And you can talk about what does the measure of success look like, right? And so when we look back at our Grizzly members that we are still in contact with, right, they're economic development officers in their community. They're working for environmental organizations across the North. They're living in Ottawa and creating art and raising a family in another community and doing great things. They're raising a family too and driving the water truck. But they're community members. They're giving back to their community. They're a positive impact where they've gone. And that's success. John Wooden, I think, talked about it, right? You know, he's most successful by the number of lawyers, teachers, doctors that he had the opportunity to coach, not by the fact that he's the winningest coach in NCAA and basketball history or whatever it might be. It's the people, right, that came through the program. And that's where you start to mark success. And you know, how many weddings did he get invited to? that would be a classification of success.
I think it's so cool how really on the ground you learned that, and you've been in Indigenous sport and you've walked that path. You've seen from where it wasn't good to where it was, from the empty to the full. And I think that you've explored the world. And Kyla, you've brought that to us today in your storytelling, and you're bringing it to Sport Manitoba all the time. And how fortunate are we that you have landed there? I want to get to our rapid fire questions, because I think you'll have some really cool things to share with us. Sorry, are you ready to go with our rapid fire questions?
Yeah, so I'll be honest, I've been cheating, right? I've been listening to the podcast and I've been trying to figure out how I would answer the rapid fire questions, and I've not been successful in answering that. So it may still be truly rapid fire. So we'll see how that goes.
What is your favorite sound?
I think it's the hum of an arena when you're the first one in there. I grew up, I was a goalie, so I needed more time to get dressed. I'd like to be at the rink early. And so we'd literally be waiting in the parking lot till the attendant opened the door and the lights would be coming on when I was going in the dressing room. And so I can remember that hum, and it's really cool.
What is something that you have struggled with that continues to affect you now that no one would know looking at you?
Well, that's one of those rapid fire questions that I was trying to answer. That I've heard from other situations. And you know what? I don't know. And Donna gives me grief for this somewhat. And I wondered if it's because I don't hold on to things. I don't know if I do struggle with things that I just haven't identified them yet to be able to verbalize it. And Donna will tell me that I'm not good at that a lot of times. I'm not one to hold on to something. So I really wonder if that's part of the reason why there's things that I feel I don't struggle with, because I don't hold on to it. Yeah, and it may be a cop-out on the question too.
No, if that's how you feel day to day that you go, I think that's great to hear that. Describe an ordinary moment.
Yeah, so an ordinary moment, and I don't know who it was that answered it, but you know, someone said on your podcast before, there is no ordinary moments, might have been Cal, right? But every morning for me is pretty much a coffee and quiet. Right. So as far as an ordinary moment for me, I don't turn the lights on. I get up, I grab my coffee and I sit in quiet. When I lived in Nunavut, the dark is really problematic for some people. But I really enjoyed walking to work before the sun, like when the sun doesn't come up at all, it never came above the horizon. And all you saw was, you know, no one was out. And there was one light on in a window of a house. But I really like that dark and quiet. And so those mornings are a typical ordinary moment for me that I enjoy.
What is one piece of advice you want to pass along to others?
I guess, I don't know if it's one or two. So be purposeful and be open. I think be purposeful in what you do, and do it with, you know, some sort of intent, and be open to the opportunity. None of my success has really come from me being self-directed in it. It's been being open to what's been presented. And so going up north was an opportunity that was presented, and I was open to it, and they took it, you know. And coming to Manitoba, I'd never lived in Manitoba. I'd never been here. And when I was applying for jobs, you know, in the Interlake as the first rec director there, I was open to the opportunity and I took it. And it's, you know, it's been fantastic. It's ultimately landed me my job in sport that I went to university for. It's ultimately landed me my family that, you know, and where we live. And so I think you have to be open to those things, and then be purposeful in the things that you're doing.
What is a quote you love?
I like quotes. There's lots of varying quotes that I use at varying times. One, it's out of Shakespeare. There's neither happy or sad, but thinking makes it so. So there's that one. And there's another Shakespeare one. If chance shall have me king, chance shall crown me without my stir. You know, maybe Hamlet. And again, I think that speaks to being open. I don't need to force something to happen. If it's going to happen, it'll happen. I just need to be open to seeing it. But someone talked about everyone has a circle, and when we cross paths with people, they intersect. And the question is whether or not you're open to receive what that person is bringing at that time, or if you're closed.
What is your favorite failure?
Toronto, and not just the Maple Leafs. I enjoy watching them fail. But I couldn't make a go of the living in Toronto. You know, I was stuck in a spot where their income didn't meet the output of my monies, right? Rent was really expensive. Going out to the bar on a regular time was really expensive. I just failed miserably there in managing finances. And I needed a change. And so because of that, and being open to Rich and Nicole's invite to go to Nunavut, that really was a great failure for me because of what it provided afterwards.
Tell us about a book you would recommend to other people and why.
I just finished reading Janice Forsythe's new book on reclaiming Tom Longboat Award around Indigenous sport. I thought that was really good, given where we're at with regards to reconciliation and the sport and what sports role looks like in there. One that sort of kept coming back in maybe having an influence on how I do work recently would be John Gordon's The Energy Bus. I thought that was really good. And we had the opportunity to hear him speak at Sport Leadership one time. And so I've read his books, and that Energy Bus one with its positive and energy vampires and sort of themes that he has there and how you approach your day-to-day. And those are two books that have been really good. I think we can pull good information from.
Do you have a few songs that you love that you would mention?
Yeah. So Home for Arrest is definitely one that I yell and scream and jump when the Spirit of the West comes on, or any iteration of that comes on. It's definitely, I'm rolling down the windows if it's in my truck and I'm belting it out. It's definitely a good Celtic fun. It has lots of stories for me in it. And I think ones that I enjoy. So yeah, Spirit of the West is one that I'll never hear to not sing along.
Who are two or three people who influenced you, and how did they impact your life?
Definitely my time with the coaches in the Grizzlies organization. I think there were some interesting learnings there. And, you know, I was there for a short period of time. There's a lot of good coaches that were there. I work closest with Russ Shepherd and Dave Little, and still in contact with them on the cross side. And they were really key in sort of helping me see what sport can do on that aspect of things. And not doing it for saving somebody, but doing it because it's important and doing it because this can be helpful, right? So landing in Manitoba, definitely sport brought me Donna. And so that's been really cool. I was her mission staff person, 2007 Canada Games, right? So again, what sport provides us if we're open and getting the opportunity to see what she does on a regular basis. She's so committed when she goes all in on something, but she's starting to learn boundaries and starting to identify what her life looks like and how she needs to be the person she wants to be. And I'm not so good on boundaries. Again, that may be the problem with the whole, if there's an open door, go through it. All right. So there's lots of opportunities. I'm sort of thinking we can do it. So she's definitely been a good influence that way. I think definitely had an impact on what I do and perhaps, again, shaping what I do from a work perspective with regards to being purposeful. And if we're going to be purposeful in what we do, then we can't do everything. Again, I am so lucky to have been in the coaching institute with two of your guests, I think Derek Ingram and Bill Johnson, and getting to learn from them and maintaining connections with them. And it was Derek who said, you know, there's no really good or bad moments or learning opportunities. They're just learning opportunities. And same thing with the people. You try to take the best of everyone you meet. So I think at every point in our life, we're learning from different people. And if we are ready to see what it is they're doing and take the best from them, and then we can be a better person because of it, and we can alter what we do and take those learnings. I think everybody, if you're looking for it and if you're open to it, can have an impact on your life. You just need to be able to identify what is it that I'm learning.
A lifelong learner. That is Kylo Harris, truly a hero in our midst, not just to Donna, but to us all. Kylo, amazing man. Your willingness to explore and let life take you where it needed you to go is selfless and incredible. And we are better for having come along with you, if even just in your story. You have inspired us to look outside of ourselves, to give where there's a need, and to continue to strive to make things better from the inside out. If you enjoyed today's story and would like to hear more, you can find us on Spotify at drtoogood.com and soon our own website. We'll keep you posted on that. Thanks for listening.